This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air's Dave Davies has today's first interview. I'll let him introduce it.
The Netflix series Unorthodox was recognized this award season with Golden Globes, Critics' Choice, and Independent Spirit Award nominations. The series, about a young woman who flees the restrictive customs of her Hasidic Jewish sect and an unhappy marriage, was inspired by the true life experiences of our guest, Deborah Feldman. Feldman grew up in the Williamsburg neighborhood of Brooklyn. Her family belonged to the Satmar community of Hasidim, known for its strictly enforced religious customs and heavily circumscribed gender roles. Feldman's memoir is a gripping account of her struggle to cope in a world where women could look forward not to education or careers, but an early arranged marriage and years of child-rearing. Her book, first published in 2012, is Unorthodox: The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots. It's now available in paperback. She's also published a second memoir called Exodus. An updated version will be released in August. She now lives in Berlin, where she's raising her son and working on a German language novel. She joins us from her home in Berlin. Deborah Feldman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I want to begin by noting that there is a wide variety of religious practices among observant Jews in the United States and around the world. And we should just note that we're going to talk a lot about it, your experience, but it's not necessarily typical of all Jews or even all Orthodox Jews or even all Hasidic Jews. You grew up in the Satmar community of Hasidim. You want to just explain a bit about its outlook on the Holocaust and on Jewish ritual and custom?
Well, I was raised by Holocaust survivors who chose to join the sect voluntarily after the war in New York. And they accepted all of these new rules and rituals that they would have only been vaguely familiar with prior to the Holocaust, because they felt, I think, a prevailing guilt for surviving, and that the Holocaust had happened as a punishment for the sins of the Jews in the diaspora, sins such as pursuing education and pursuing things like integration and assimilation, and even sins like Zionism. And the only way to build a world in which a Holocaust would not occur was to take each and every traditional rule and regulation and interpret it to an extreme.
So describe some of the rules for women in the world that you grew up in. Some of them are Satmar specific. Some of them belong to many other Jewish Orthodox communities. But just what were some of the rules for girls and women in your world?
Well, like all religions we know today and all Orthodox Jewish groups, the rules begin by focusing to an extreme extent on the dress, comportment, and behavior of women. So when I was younger, what was very obvious was all of the rules surrounding how I was to dress, which colors I was allowed to wear, what kind of fabrics, what kind of cuts and styles, how long my skirts had to be, how long my sleeves, how I was supposed to wear my hair, how loud I was allowed to talk or laugh, how should I behave if I were to walk on the street and another man would be walking in my direction, you know, how to step aside. So it was very much designed to make me as inconspicuous as possible. And you spend your entire childhood very aware of this, of the problematic nature of your female presence and of the necessity to negate it and to cover it up.
It's interesting that when you look at Williamsburg, I mean, it's right there on the edge of the East River, and you can look across and see the skyline of Manhattan. And it's really striking to me that thousands of people can grow up in a fairly socially isolated way in this city, which is the largest and maybe the most diverse city in the United States. You were kind of more outward looking, weren't you?
Well, I think prior to being outward looking, I was certainly lonely and unhappy. I was already different by virtue of my circumstances, being raised by my grandparents instead of by my parents, having parents that were divorced, having a mother that had disappeared. I mean, there were so many strikes against me from the beginning.
As you got older, the idea of marriage comes into focus. Let's talk just a bit about the steps in arranging a marriage. You said a lot of your life was sort of managed by your aunt, who you call Chaya, and she finds a matchmaker, right? And how are you first introduced to the family of the man that you've been chosen to marry?
Yes. So I'm 17 years old, and my family has been researching for months, and they've been working, you know, without my knowledge for months, meeting with the family and sort of deciding everything in advance. And then at the very last minute, it just boils down to the physical acceptance of my presence, right? I need to be seen. It needs to be ascertained that I am not too ugly to be married. And so I am told to go to the supermarket, and I am told to dress up in my best clothes and to carry my beautiful new handbag, because suddenly I've been showered with beautiful things because I am now of age. And I go to the supermarket in these beautiful clothes and carrying this handbag and feeling so grown up. And my aunt says to me, just, you know, walk along the aisles and pretend you're looking for something. And I'm like, why do I do this? And she says, because your future mother-in-law will now watch you. And so I have no idea what my future mother-in-law might look like, but I know there is a woman in the shop, and she's come here to see me, and she's come here to pronounce me worthy or unworthy. And if you are rejected, that rejection is crushing. It goes into your resume. So before you even think about what the acceptance might mean, you know, marrying into that family, marrying the son of this woman, you just think of that rejection, the prospect of the rejection and how crushing it can be. And I think this is so clever, the way that this gets set up, because everything about the way the system works makes you value that arranged marriage. It makes you want it because the alternative is so much worse. And so I'm walking in the supermarket and just hoping against hope that some person that I've never met looks at me and thinks I pass muster.
Right. So it's interesting that you got very little notice that this was going to happen, this trip to the supermarket where an important evaluation of you would occur. Similarly, after that, when the mother-in-law apparently told the matchmaker, yep, she's acceptable, there's a meeting of the families at which you will finally meet the man that's been chosen for you. Again, you get very little notice of this. Just get your best stuff on. We're going over to Aunt Chaya's house. Describe what happens in this encounter between the two families and you and your future husband.
Once everyone arrives, they all sit around a large table and they make small talk. And the young man and woman in question mostly sit in silence and sneak glances at each other. And then eventually, after enough small talk has been made and they assume that we feel relatively comfortable, they leave the room, they go into the next room, they close the door almost completely, but leave it open a crack because the law requires that. And we are left to our devices for about 20 to 30 minutes. We have to make conversation. I'm told that the man has to start the conversation, so I stay silent. He takes a few moments to come up with an idea of what to say, and those first few moments are awkward. But eventually he speaks, and it turns out he's quite nice. There's nothing about him that would make me skeptical or fearful. He's relatively attractive. He seems intelligent. He seems kind, sensible. Like, I only notice with relief, with tremendous relief, that he has good qualities. And, you know, you're thinking the whole time, it could be so much worse. It could be someone who's so fundamentalist, they won't even look at you, even though they're supposed to be looking at you to decide if they're going to marry you. You could be with someone who is selfish or who is pigheaded or diffident. I mean, there's so many ways that things could go wrong. So in that moment, I'm just thinking, well, there is nothing I can pinpoint that's bad.
And so then the deal, it's not like then you retreat and you have a week to think about it, right? I mean, you make a decision and it's indicated literally by a nod to your aunt. Is this right?
Yes, because it's already clear by the time that you're told that you're going to see this man, it's already clear by seeing him you are engaged to him, because the consequences would be so drastic if you weren't to become engaged. You would lose so much value on the market that whatever would come next would be much worse, certainly, than whatever it is that could be bad about this person. So you know, even before, that it's going to be engagement. And that's why you feel such intense relief in this moment when you realize your partner isn't obviously terrible. And yes, there is that look and the nod, but it's just perfunctory. Everything has already been prepared. You know, the alcohol is already on the table. And as soon as the meeting is done, there is a verbal agreement and we all drink to it and it's over. There's no going back.
So your wedding night comes and the marriage is not consummated that night. You simply are unable to have intercourse. And the next day is the day that you actually get your head shaved because you're going to have to wear a wig. And your mother-in-law drops in. And what happens?
I'm sort of happy to welcome her into my brand new domain, right? I'm putting out the nice dishes that I have and the nice napkins, and I want to, you know, serve her coffee and, you know, play house. And she immediately says, I know that it didn't work. And at the beginning, I'm just too surprised to understand what's happening. Like, what does she know? How does she know it? Does she assume it? And she explains that her husband told her that my husband had told him that we had attempted to consummate the marriage and we had failed at doing so. And before this moment, I thought this is normal. Lots of couples probably have this the first night. You come home at 5 a.m. You're so tired. You don't know what you're doing. Like, so we'll just try again the next night, right? Like at this point, I was still quite relaxed. And then she came in, you know, with this stony face, like, this is the end of the world. Your marriage isn't consummated. You're not married. Like, you're living in sin, basically, because you're not married. And it was this big deal. It was this, like, halachic problem, which is, like, a problem of Jewish law that had to be decided in the Jewish court. And, you know, Jewish advisors and rabbis had to be called in to pronounce their verdict on us. It was humiliating, shameful. Everybody knew within a day that we hadn't consummated, that we hadn't managed it. And I was ashamed to walk on the street because I had no idea who knew and who didn't.
And of course, this information came from your husband, who immediately told his family. And that's a practice that goes on. You end up getting medical exams because this goes on quite a while. I mean, you continue to have difficulty and you get advice from sex therapists and rabbis and hypnotists and a biofeedback specialist. You know, with some years of distance and perspective, do you understand what was going on?
I think that I understand it as best as I ever will. And I think that my husband at the time was in a very comparable situation. I think that we both grew up denying our bodies, not developing any kind of relationship with them, not understanding how they work or how they might work for us, not understanding how to enjoy them or how to understand their signals. And when you're just so disconnected from your body, sex doesn't work. And sure, maybe it could work in some cases anyway, but a lot has to go well. You know, you don't know this person. You don't even know if you like them. Everything has to function, and you need emotional and mental involvement for that to happen. Maybe that's possible with time. Maybe two young people could still have a chance to get to know each other and build some trust and maybe discover their bodies in that moment, even though they've always been disconnected from them. But as soon as the community gets involved and puts this sacred pressure on the couple, it must be done, otherwise your holy duty has not been fulfilled, that chance goes up in smoke. And it doesn't end well. In my story, I do manage to get pregnant at some point, but at the cost of great pain. And my family considered the problem solved, but it was far from solved.
You do have a son, and then you move out of Williamsburg to a town north of New York City called Airmont, where there's a large Orthodox community. There's a remarkable moment you described that I have to ask you about. When you're 6 months pregnant, and a rabbi comes from Jerusalem, who's coming through, and he's very well known. He's a Kabbalist from this mystical strain of Judaism, and it's seen as something terrific if you can get a session with him for his insights. You do this, and then he tells you something that he thinks could be a problem in your marriage, which is really striking. You want to share this with us?
He says that the matchmaker
is resentful because she didn't get paid enough. And I think this sounds strange to you because it's so foreign, but actually where I come from, there are all these superstitious ideas that, you know, people can put the evil eye on you, which is something you find in a lot of traditional cultures. And so one of the first things a Kabbalist will always look for when there's a problem is who could possibly cast an evil eye on you. And since I had told him about the problems in the beginning of our marriage, even though at that point I was already pregnant, he said to me, you know, all of your problems are probably because the woman who arranged your marriage is angry that you didn't get enough money. And it turned out in this case to be true. But you know, at the time, I was grasping for straws. I would have loved to believe that it was that simple. It wasn't that simple. We ended up giving the matchmaker more money. It didn't fix any problems. But of course, there is this superstitious belief that if you can make somebody happy and you can kind of get rid of the evil eye, everything will be A-okay. It wasn't. But something else happened at that session where, you know, the Kabbalist basically hinted to me that I would end up leaving the community. He implied it in, you know, in a symbolic way, but he told me that I would die and I would be reborn, that I would go my own path and that my child would be instrumental in this. And he gave me a number. He gave me a number 9. And I ended up having this terrifying and an insane car accident on midnight, September 9th, 2009. Where my car just, like, the front tire ripped and it flipped over 3 times and it was torn apart in pieces and I ended up emerging without a scratch. And I ended up seeing this moment as like an impetus to leave because I felt that God wasn't punishing me with a car accident, but rather showing me that I could survive anything. And it gave me the courage to leave the very next day. And because of this, like, him telling me this number 9 and, you know, dying and being reborn, I ended up reading it as a prediction, that he predicted that I would leave my old life and be reborn into a new one. But maybe I'm just still very superstitious.
How does the number 9 figure into the car accident?
Well, it occurred exactly at midnight on September 9, 2009. So on my phone, you know, when I crawled out of the car, it was 999. And, you know, you get chills. It's a coincidence, right? But it creeps you out.
You know, in the series Unorthodox, part of it's kind of your story and part of it's an imagined story. I mean, in the series, the character who's based on you, whose name is Esty, makes a daring escape from Brooklyn, the Williamsburg area of Brooklyn, to Berlin, where her mother lives. That's really not your story. You went from Brooklyn to this community in called Airmont in north of New York City. And eventually you took a class at Sarah Lawrence College and got interested in writing and had more and more contact with secular people. Eventually, after this terrible car accident, you decide to leave the community. Had to be very tough. You had a son. You didn't have, you know, a degree. How did you manage to put together the resources and wherewithal to make a life?
Well, I mean, I don't know if what I had in those first few years could rightly be called a life. I mean, I would call it survival or hanging on to the very edge of survival. I left on faith. I think it's important to say that because where I come from, faith is everything. And when you leave this community, you also leave on faith because that's how you've been trained to take risks. I sold my jewelry. I sold a book proposal. I had enough money to make a start, and I got very creative later when the money ran out. I would sublet my apartment for a few weeks and go stay with friends. I donated my eggs at some point to survive. So the first few years were really just about survival. It was about day to day, month to month. It was about getting custody of my son. It was about finding my footing, you know, the very basics.
It is remarkable that you sold a book proposal. I mean, people spend years trying to do this.
I agree.
I think probably you had quite a literary education, self-taught, and you had a powerful story to tell, didn't you?
I started by blogging. I think that was how it even came to be, because a publisher saw my blog and referred her to an agent, and an agent offered to help me. And I got 25 rejections from publishers before David Rosenthal at Simon & Schuster called my agent and asked me to come in for a meeting. And after meeting me, he made an offer, a very, very generous offer, considering the era and, you know, the fact that I was unknown and so young and had no experience. And so we went to publication with a very small print run, and yet the book exploded. And I remember everyone around me just pondering, like, how to explain it, how to explain that the book did explode against all expectations. And I remember my agent being like, oh, well, you know, maybe there is something very American about your story after all, just like the stories about women running away from the Mormon communities and the Amish communities and the Mennonite communities. Like, maybe running away from religion is the quintessential American story. So all of a sudden, I wasn't this niche, like, weirdo, but all of a sudden, I was the ultimate American. I was the person that ran away from the religious sect. And if you look at the landscape of America, there's something very national about that.
Deborah Feldman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me again, Dave.
Deborah Feldman's memoir, Unorthodox, The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots, was the inspiration for the Netflix series Unorthodox. She spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Julian Baker's third studio album called Little Oblivions. Since her debut in 2015, Baker has become one of the most highly praised figures in indie rock. She's also known for being one-third of the vocal group Boy Genius, along with fellow singer-songwriters Phoebe Bridgers and Lucy Dacus. Ken says Baker's new album presents frank discussions of mental distress and addiction embedded in frequently beautiful music.
I miss the high, sings Julian Baker on Faith Healer, one of the rare songs about addiction that remembers the marvelous allure of it as vividly as the awful pain of it. Only in her mid-20s, Baker seems already to possess a lifetime's understanding of how people can hurt themselves. She's been frank about this in interviews and in her lyrics, but she's not a baldly confessional writer. She's in this business for the art.
Wish that I drank because of you and not only because of me. And then I could blame something painful enough not to make me look anymore weak. When you heard my name, you could be angry and have a good reason to be. And then when I sang a horrible drunken parade of my worst thoughts, I'd say give me no sympathy. It's the mercy I can't take.
That song, it's called Song in E, sounds like Julian Baker sitting alone at the piano trying to figure out the easiest way to blow up her life, telling a lover, I wish you'd hurt me. It's the mercy I can't take. She's placing anyone who loves her in an impossible position, and she knows it. As she sings on another song in a great turn of phrase, I'm not crying wolf, I'm out here looking for them.
Day one, chip on your dresser, get loaded at your house. I ask if you remember, you say I don't know what you're talking about. Swallow the truth. truth forced the charcoal down my throat. Finally come to, maybe I'll have something to show. It's the first day of the new year.
The title of the album says it all. Little oblivions are those moments during the high when you can forget your problems, your ego, your pain. In the song where that phrase appears, the tune called Bloodshot, Baker looks deep into the eyes of someone wounded, someone Baker herself has wounded. And in those eyes, she sees her own hopeless attraction to various little oblivions.
I can see myself inside your bloodshot eyes, wondering if you can see yourself in mine, or do you just
Listening to her previous releases, I was more impressed by Baker's approach to lyrics than her sound, which tended toward the burned out and monochromatic. But there's a new variety and depth on Little Oblivions, with Baker supplying nearly all of the guitars, drums, synthesizers, banjo, and mandolin. And it's not just a one-person band feat or trick, it's the sound of a musician putting together her life, piece by piece. I love the steady build and rock and roll forcefulness of a song such as Ringside.
Beat myself until I'm bloody, and I'll give you a ringside seat. Say that it's embarrassing. I'm sorry that you had to see. Save me while I drag you down. I wanna fix it, but I don't know how. It isn't fair to make you wait around. While all your friends are gone.
Climax of that wonderful song, Baker sings, "Nobody deserves a second chance, but honey, I keep getting them." So many of these songs are about Julian Baker taking responsibility for herself, thinking about her past behavior, owning up to her mistakes. You might listen to the tone of voice and read her lyrics on the internet and think that this would make for a depressing, downbeat experience. Instead, it's thrilling. To be in the presence of someone who has seized hold of her life and is describing it in a way that no one else ever has. For Baker, that's how you redeem a life.
Ken Tucker reviewed Julian Baker's new album, Little Oblivions. My guest, Kazuo Ishiguro, won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2017. He's best known for his novels Remains of the Day and Never Let Me Go, which were each adapted into popular films. In reviewing his new novel, Clara and the Sun, our book critic Maureen Corrigan described Ishiguro as the master of slowly deepening our awareness of human failing, fragility, and the inevitability of death. All that, even as he deepens our awareness of what temporary magic it is to be alive in the first place. Clara and the Sun takes place sometime in the near future. Something has created a great disruption in society. Society is stratified. Privileged people are known as high-ranking. People who have lost their jobs to very smart machines are known as substituted. The substituted have had to redefine their lives, for better or worse. Children no longer go to school. They learn on their devices. They don't see other children, except for what's known as interaction meetings. But some children have artificial friends, or AFs, which are artificial beings who look like real people, but are programmed with artificial intelligence and kept alive by solar-powered batteries that have a limited life that ends with a slow fade. The narrator of the story is an artificial friend named Clara, who's chosen to live with Josie, a teenager who's sick and may be dying. The novel is about what it means to be human in a world where humans have created a rigid hierarchy of winners and losers, and people are isolated from one another, but can develop close relationships with machines powered by artificial intelligence, machines that appear more devoted and self-sacrificing than other people do. In a world like that, what does it mean to have a human heart? Are we deluding ourselves when we think that everything that makes us unique can't be duplicated by a machine? Kazuo Ishiguro was born in 1954 in Nagasaki, after it was decimated by the atom bomb and then rebuilt. When he was 5, he moved with his family to England, where he continues to live. Kazuo Ishiguro, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's been too long, so it's a pleasure to have you back. Does this book have a resonance that you didn't even expect it to have because of its release during the pandemic? Schools are closed, and in your novel, children don't go to school anymore. People are isolated from one another and are interacting through their computers. They're learning. Children are learning on their devices. Did you make any tweaks after the pandemic? I mean, the book is new. You wouldn't have had a lot of time to make changes.
No. If there are any reverberations, they're purely coincidental. You know, I finished the book before the pandemic, and I have to say, it took me completely by surprise. You know, I didn't know something on this scale was coming up. I couldn't have dreamt that, you know, something like this would happen. Maybe in some other sense, you could say that there's an underlying atmosphere of kind of global crisis and things hitting society. I mean, in the novel, I'm talking about a society that is undergoing profound changes, and it doesn't quite know how to reorganize itself.
I have to say, the narrator of your novel is the artificial friend, Clara. And who wouldn't want a friend as self-sacrificing and devoted as Clara is, someone who's programmed to learn everything they can about you and to please you? And honestly, I found Clara the most sympathetic character in the novel. I mean, she's pure in a lot of ways, even though she's artificial.
It shouldn't be that surprising, really, though, that an artificial creature could actually solicit our sympathies as much as a human one. I mean, because after all, you know, characters in books are artificial. Yeah, I mean, we're making that kind of leap anyway. When we read books and get weepy over the fate of some character, we're not weeping over a real person. We've put ourselves into some kind of space where we're relating to kind of created beings, and we're, at some level, we're responding metaphorically because we think it impinges in some metaphorical relationship to our real lives, I suppose. So I never thought it was going to actually be an intrinsic problem in terms of how my readers will feel because my main character was artificial.
Clara is seeing the world and people in the world as an outsider. She's programmed to know the things that she knows, but she's learning about, like, human emotion, and she's learning about people and about the outside world from experience. And the more experience she has, the more she understands about emotion and feelings. So what is the advantage to you as a writer, writing from the point of view of such an outsider who's apart from the world and is just kind of learning about it?
I think I've always been drawn to, you know, throughout my career, to narrators who are in one way or the other quite a bit on the outside. But Clara was especially interesting for me because she doesn't bring any baggage with her. It's not like, you know, she has her value system, which kind of clashes with what she finds. She's like a tabula rasa at the beginning, and she's quite childlike and very open. And so it's not just the very restricted way in which she actually reads the world that appealed to me. I wanted some of that childlike freshness and openness and naivety to survive all the way through the text in her. I wanted her to remain like a very optimistic character who has a childlike faith in the presence of something good and protective in the world, even as she learns all these other things, darker things about the human world that she occupies.
Clara is solar powered, but the solar powered battery, or, you know, power source, has a limited lifespan. because she and other artificial friends need the sun to stay powered, to stay alive, she thinks of the sun as God and basically prays to it, asking for help, asking for interventions when she needs it, promising to do good things in return. She doesn't understand that the sun isn't a god, that the sun doesn't live in the place where she sees it set every night, that the sun can be too harsh for human beings. And I assume that's in part because of the disappearing ozone layer that also she doesn't understand. Is this a way of expressing what you think of religion, that it's a kind of false premise in a way, that we create gods because we misunderstand our own creation, our own selves?
I don't think I was trying to be critical of religion. I just thought Clara would reflect that aspect of humanity like she reflects other aspects of humanity. And this isn't something that she really learns, as you point out, from humans. I mean, many other things she learns when she gets out into the human world and she becomes more and more human-like. But this is something that's there from the start because she's solar powered, I suppose. And it's perfectly logical for her to think, you know, the sun is a source of all nourishment as far as she and her fellow AFs in the store are concerned. But then when she looks out the shop window into the street, it kind of makes sense to her that the sun is actually nourishing everybody. And that's the way it looks. You know, there are these big, tall buildings and the sun is coming down in shafts and people are being nourished by the sun. You know, they're happy when the sun comes out. And so she holds on to this belief, I suppose, that the sun is the source of good things and that the sun is always watching over everybody. And when she needs to save the family that she lives with from impending heartbreak, the sun is naturally the person that she turns to. I mean, the sun is a person for her. And she goes to ask the sun's help. You could say this is like a religious instinct or whatever, but I mean, I found it very interesting to remove the usual kind of the social context away, you know, take it away and just have it in this rather pure, naive, artificial being, that she too could actually repeat these patterns of belief and faith, and that there should be something rather touching about it. I thought that was quite interesting.
Your father was an oceanographer. Am I right in saying that he was an engineer?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, so, I mean, he was like an inventor.
When I was growing up, I didn't have any sense that like the machines in my life were invented by somebody. You know, like they existed. And they were, you know, I didn't understand how they worked. But with your father having like created things, because I think one of the things or machines, I'm not sure what it was exactly that he created, is in a museum in England. Did you have a sense growing up that like technology is created by people, that people actually do that, that they're not things that just exist? Like people like your father create them.
Yeah, I think I probably did. My father spent his whole life, his working life, just creating this one machine. He had a little department under him. That's why we were in Britain, because the British were funding his research. And he just made the one machine. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like Steve Jobs, you know, oh, I'm going to make this and then I'm going to launch this. He just worked on this one machine that could predict storms at sea. And yeah, as you say, I mean, that machine is now not in just any museum, it's in the Science Museum in London. That's the main big museum for science in London, in the United Kingdom. And so I'm very proud of that. But yes, I grew up, although I grew up with this kind of, with a lot of science in the family, one of the things that I now kind of regret and perhaps hold myself accountable for is the fact that I didn't take any advantage of it. I think there's this kind of severe barrier between the world of the humanities and the arts on the one side and science on the other. And I was probably, you know, I kind of imbibed something of that climate. Maybe there's less of it in the United States, I don't know. And so I wasn't nearly as interested in science as I should have been. And from a very early age, I kind of siloed myself off in the world of books and music. And I kind of thought science didn't have very much to do with me. And it's only you know, in old age, as I am now, I realized how much the world of science and the rest of the world, you know, the world that authors live in, are just interconnected.
So when you came to England from Japan with your parents, because your father had a job with, that was supposed to be temporary as a researcher, you moved to, I think it was Guildford, and it sounds very rural. You were like 5 minutes away from a farm. There were hedgehogs around. The milk was delivered by a horse and wagon.
Yeah, that's all true, yeah. Mm-hmm. The farm was less than 5 minutes. It was more or less right there. Mm.
So you were used to like a rebuilt city, Nagasaki, and the new technology of the time. Did you feel like you were entering like a different world and a different era?
It certainly felt like a different world. And it felt like a much quieter, less colorful world, I have to say. I mean, the children's toys were very muted, you know, and rather austere. And this was 1960. And what people in America perhaps wouldn't understand is that Britain had gone through a period of huge austerity after the Second World War. You know, Britain had become a very, very poor place. There was rationing until the 1950s. You know, people had to present tickets to just get their portion of food. And I think that's something very hard for people in America to understand, because the 1950s were, you know, huge boom years in America. And even compared to Japan, you know, it's like in 1960, England felt impoverished. You know, that there wasn't a variety of color and toys and, you know, excitement, particularly from a child's point of view. You know. But I really appreciated the rural countryside as it was. I mean, it wasn't real countryside, but I mean, you know, the town more or less ended where our house was. And I grew up kind of in these English fields and English trees. And my parents' friends were kind of very, very old-fashioned English types. You know.
So you were a choir boy in church in England. Did your parents practice any religion in Japan?
No, they were without religion. I remember at one point when I was about 15 or something, I asked what was our religion, because I know that in Japan you had to have an official religion on your birth certificate. I think mainly to prove that you weren't Christian. It dates back to some era when Christians were seen as a threat. So everyone has to have an official religion. My mother had to actually go upstairs to look it up. And she said, you know, well, we're Buddhists, wow. But I'll just go and tell you what kind of Buddhists. And she came back down and said, yes, we're all Zen Buddhists. So I thought, all right, so we're all Zen Buddhists. But I mean, the attitude to religion was kind of like that, you know. And I would say that's fairly typical of a Japanese family, that the role of religion, with some exceptions, but by and large, you know, religion is not the same kind of thing it tends to be in the West. And most Japanese people would have a Shinto shrine and a Buddhist shrine in their homes, as was the case in the house I spent the first 5 years of my life in. You had them both there, and you decorate them for different festivals and things like that. They don't seem to have a deeper religious identity attached to them.
So, you know, you won the Nobel in 2017. I could see how that could be a real confidence booster when you need it. You know, well, I might not feel like a great writer today, but I won the Nobel. But it's also something you have to measure up to. Like, am I really worthy? You know, so has it served to boost your confidence and make you more insecure at the same time?
I might find this out soon. When I sit down and try and write another novel, I was already about a third of the way through Clara and the Sun when I won the Nobel Prize. So I was already, it was all firmly on its rails, you know. So I came back and I was kind of surprised that somebody hadn't, in the meantime, while I was away getting this prize, they hadn't gone into my study and made it much grander. Because it was exactly the same study. It was, you know, I have this really disheveled, tiny study, and papers everywhere. And all the problems that I had in front of me about Clara and the Sun were still exactly there, you know, literally, you know, like the Marie Celeste. I mean, it was exactly as I left it. I'd been away from the novel for about 6 months because, you know, you don't just go and pick up the prize. All kinds of things happen. But I might discover something like what you're saying later on. But at the moment, and I think this is by and large how I've experienced prizes and honors throughout my career. It feels to me like that happens somewhere outside, out there, on a different planet almost, in a parallel universe. And the person who receives these things is some sort of avatar. Yeah. And I'm really proud and grateful to get these honors because many, many writers who are as good as me or better don't get these honors. So let me just say that I'm profoundly grateful for them. However, when I'm writing in my disheveled, untidy study, it's got nothing to do with what I'm doing. You know, I have a very lonely sense of success or failure. You know, I'm trying to bring something into being, and sometimes I can do it, and sometimes I can't. And that's about the extent of it, really.
Kazuo Ishiguro, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's a great honor to speak to you.
Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel is called Clara and the Sun.